So we were talking last time about feedbacks, which are sort of these loops of cause and effect that can change the way that the climate system will respond to our provocation by putting more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And so to just kind of remember where we were with that, I've got a couple of clicker questions. So supply and demand, is that a positive feedback or a negative feedback? Need to remember which one is which. One of the two tends to amplify. If you perturb something, it makes it worse. It's like an amplifier. And the other kind of feedback is a stabilizer. And so there were the positive and the negative. So supply and demand on the price of coffee. So we're about evenly split on this one. Actually, supply and demand is a mechanism that, in theory, you know, economic theory holds sway at this university, so we'll stick to it. In theory, it stabilizes the prices of things. If things get too expensive, then not enough people will buy them, and so then the price will have to drop because, you know, the price always finds the point at which the supply equals demand. And so stabilizing, that's a negative feedback. That means that if the price is too high, that would be like a positive excursion. And the supply and demand mechanism would then push the price back down toward the equilibrium one. So this is a stabilizing negative feedback. Housing prices. Housing prices had this sort of a, yeah, there you go, it's a positive feedback. They've had this dynamic over the past couple of years where people buy houses as investments, planning that the price is going to keep going up. And so if the price goes up a little bit, then people buy more real estate because they think it's going to keep going up, and so that tends to drive it up even further. So that would be an example of a positive feedback. So that's an amplifier, and so you get this sort of bubble effect. And of course, we can't talk about feedbacks without going to the master. Jimi Hendrix, with his guitar, would be standing in front of a big amplifier, giant speakers, right? And the sound coming out from the speakers at some frequency picks up it makes the strings on the guitar move, and then that sends sound back to the amplifier, which makes the amplifier make more noise, and so that too is a positive feedback. You're right. All right, so the water vapor feedback is a feedback that we talked about last time in some depth, in some sort of, you know, you saw some pretty technical stuff about the phase diagram of water and all of that, the runaway greenhouse effect on Venus and why it's probably not going to happen here, but it could happen if, you know, we were closer to the sun or the sun was hotter. Okay, so say you want to go read a column from your favorite pundit, George Will, for example, Washington Post, and he writes something along the lines of, well, CO2 is not even as strong a gas as water vapor, so, you know, why are we worrying about CO2? What would be the response that would be appropriate in, say, a letter to the editor of George Will's boss at the newspaper? You could say, yeah, you're right, let's forget about it and go home. Or B, you could dispute the fact and say, no, actually CO2 is stronger. Would that be right? Or C, but water vapor can't change because its concentration is set by rainfall, not by people with their lawn sprinklers. And so there's a negative feedback involving water vapor, not a positive feedback, so that's not a problem. Or is it D, but actually the water vapor is part of a positive feedback with temperature? This is sort of a goofy question. I'm totally giving it away by the way I asked it, I can tell. But the answer is, the best answer is D, that water vapor actually makes the climate response to CO2 worse. In fact, it about according to the models of climate and sort of basic thinking on it, it about doubles the sensitivity of the climate to CO2. So if it weren't for, if we had a just totally dry planet, it would maybe warm up half as much from rising CO2 as it is expected to with the water vapor feedback, because the water vapor is involved in this positive feedback with temperature. So changes in the temperature lead to changes in the evaporation and precipitation of water vapor, which leads to a positive feedback. It amplifies the original temperature change. And of course, actually, answer C is correct here too. It's not really as complete an answer, but it's a valid answer that the vapor is controlled by the hydrological cycle, which is a negative feedback. So maybe over here we'd want to write that in the warmer world you have more vapor pressure. Okay, so the water vapor feedback was one of the two feedbacks that we talked about last time that were sort of new to you. The other one is the ice albedo feedback. Albedo, you remember, is the reflection of visible light, and ice is very shiny. It tends to reflect lots of light back to space, and so if you melt ice by warming the planet, you get a positive feedback that looks like this. So it gets a little cold, the snow covers the ground and increases the albedo and makes it even colder. Or if it starts to warm, then you melt some sea ice and the sunlight gets absorbed by the ground or by the ocean, and so that makes it even warmer. It's an interesting thing. An ice sheet tends to sort of stabilize its own existence. By reflecting visible light away, it tends to make sort of local cooling, and it makes itself, you know, persist for longer than if there were no feedback. But once it starts to go, it goes, you know, kind of quickly, because when it melts, it changes the energy balance. So I want to talk about another potential climate feedback today, which has had a huge impact on the weather just in the last couple of days and on attendance today, because it's such a lovely day out today, you know, who wants to come inside? The potential feedback is clouds. Clouds are one of the hardest things to get to do in a satisfying way in a climate model, because they're hard to model because they are controlled by stuff that goes on a very wide range of spatial scales. So we talked a couple of lectures ago when we introduced winds and storms and Coriolis and all of that and the heat transport, that the way that you have to simulate climate has to include all that stuff, and so you do a model on some sort of a grid like that, like a big checkerboard over the whole world. And these grid points are, you know, 100 kilometers on a side or something like that. And if you try to put in more grid points, if you double the number of grid points in all three dimensions, that means that you've got 2 to the third more, you know, math problems to do. Each grid point, you have to do a math problem every time step. So you got more grid points, you got more math you got to do. Plus, these models step forward in time, and they're limited how long a time step they can take, or else they blow up. If you try to go too far, you know, take a time step of a day or something like that, the equations kind of blow up. You have to take time step of like 5 minutes or something. And when you make these grid points smaller, you have to take shorter time steps. So that means that every time you try to double the resolution of one of these models, it gets a lot, takes a lot longer to run on a computer. Well, it turns out that what happens in clouds, there's little winds that have updrafts and downdrafts and things, and when the air goes up, you get condensation of the droplets. But then the droplets might coalesce to form bigger droplets, and that happens because big ones are falling faster than little ones, and so they sort of sweep out the air and they grow that way. And so if we wanted to do clouds just based on fundamental stuff like Newton's laws of motion and the energy that you get when you go from vapor to liquid and that sort of stuff that we've been talking about, fundamental stuff, you'd have to have a grid resolution that would be just really, really, really tiny. And there's just no way, even given how much faster computers are than they were, 10 years ago, there's no way we can really do clouds from first principles, which is what we would really like to do. So clouds, modeling clouds always involves kind of, they call it parameterization, which is kind of a nice word for some sort of a lookup table or, faking it in some way. You can't really, just put in Newton's laws and get clouds out the other end. You have to sort of put in stuff that's kind of at a higher level. Supply and demand is also a parameterization. So it's sort of a way of faking. The first principle model that you'd like. So if you wanted to do supply and demand from first principles, you'd have to have some sort of a mathematical description of, greed and envy and fear and speculation and all the things that, go into people's decisions whether to buy stuff or not buy stuff. So you can't really do that from first principles either. So they come up with these sort of curves, supply and price, and they draw these lines, and it kind of looks like reality. That's sort of what they have to do with clouds too. You have to sort of come up with some way of predicting what clouds are going to look like that's not really based on the real fundamentals the way you would like, because it just can't be done at this point. So clouds have several different impact effects on the climate, some of which we've already talked about, and you've sort of played around with yourself already in the lab, and some of which you'll play around with more this week. So the part of what clouds do to climate that we've already talked about is in the infrared, because cloud drops or ice drops, which is what the form the water is in if it's sort of high up. Most of the rain that hits the ground actually, astonishingly, was frozen, but not that long ago from when it hit you, but it warms up as it comes down through the air. So it's not sort of rain all the way up. It's snow even in the summertime if you go up high enough. So cloud drops or ice particles are black bodies. That is, they absorb all the infrared and they emit a complete, nice, smooth, pretty much black body spectrum. So in contrast to the greenhouse gases, which are very choosy about what light they absorb and emit, clouds can do it all. And so clouds can absorb the light that's trying to get out from through the atmospheric window, for example. So how much of an effect clouds have on the climate depends on the temperature of the cloud relative to the temperature of the ground. Because if they're at the same temperature, then it doesn't matter if, you know, the energy from the ground gets absorbed by the cloud, you know, 10 feet off the ground where it's the same temperature, and then it gets emitted from there. That's no different than if it just came from the ground directly. But if the ground is really warm and the clouds are very high up, and you absorb all the intense infrared from the warm ground, and then you emit sort of weak infrared, because the cloud is cold, then you've had a big effect on the energy balance. So in terms of the infrared effect on the energy, high clouds have a stronger effect on climate than low ones. And the infrared effect of clouds, is it gonna warm the planet or is it gonna cool the planet? Put clouds in. Could it go either way? Come on, be brave. Talk. Warm, thank you, yes. And so these are always warming. So the other side of the coin that we haven't talked about yet is visible light. And that's a huge effect. You walk outside and stand there in the glorious sunshine, and you will know exactly what I'm talking about immediately. You can feel the sunlight, and it has a strong effect. So when visible light comes in to a cloud, there are sort of two different things that it can that can happen. One is that it can be absorbed, as we've talked about before when we talked about albedo, and so it turns into heat energy, and then it gets re-emitted as infrared. It's infrared because the cloud droplets are not 5,000 degrees C. They're not as hot as the sun. They're not, you know, screaming white hot. They're sort of room temperature. So what you get there is infrared. But there's another thing, which is actually much more important for clouds, which is a phenomenon called scattering. So the idea is that, let's see, so visible scattering then reflects the same visible light that came in. So it's sort of bouncing off sort of like a mirror rather than being absorbed and emitted. So, you know, we sort of talked about this before when we were doing albedo. But now with cloud droplets, it's kind of cool. We can talk about how exactly this scattering occurs. So let's say we have some light coming in, and it's got this electric field that's oscillating back and forth. And then it hits a water droplet. And water can conduct electricity. And it's possible to sort of, by tugging on it with an electric field, it's possible to make the droplet have a little bit of a charge asymmetry, a dipole moment. You know, like we were talking about the gases, if you put negative atoms on one side, like oxygens, and positives on the other, you get sort of this dipole moment, so it interacts with infrared light. This is a lot like that, only we're sort of sloshing the charge around in this water droplet. So the light is coming in, and it tugs the electrical field one direction, then the other direction, and back and forth, and back and forth. And the electric field of this water droplet kind of rings like a bell. It kind of goes in the same frequency as the light that's coming in, because that's how you're tugging on it. And so this thing can then emit visible light in the same frequency as the light that came in. And it might go in some totally different direction. So that's why it's called scattering. It comes and then it kind of shoots off in some other direction, and it can shoot off back to space. So this scattering kind of adds to the albedo of the Earth. Now it turns out that the efficiency of this scattering, how much of the light is going to get scattered versus how much is going to get absorbed, is a very sensitive function of the drop size. So this is most likely to happen if the size, the drop size, is comparable to the wavelength of the light. So if the drop was like this big around, and you've got this little tiny thing of light coming in, it can't really torque the electric field of that droplet very much. It works best if the sizes are kind of matched. So it turns out that the wavelength of visible light is actually smaller, quite a bit smaller, like a factor of 10 or so smaller than most cloud droplets. So this distance here might be half 0.5 microns, micrometers, where a micrometer 10 to the minus 6 meters, so pretty tiny. Whereas cloud droplets are sort of typically about 10 micrometers in size. So the scattering would be much more efficient if the cloud droplets were 10 times smaller than they are. But as it is, the smaller the better. The smaller the cloud droplets, the more they scatter. So if you go outside and you look at the clouds and they're really, really bright, that doesn't really threaten you that it's going to rain on you, right? Rain clouds are dark clouds. I went out running this morning and there are these dark clouds up in the north. Ooh, that looked like rain. And they're dark because the cloud droplets are big, so they absorb the sunlight. If the cloud is really bright, that means it's scattering the sunlight. That means the cloud droplets are small. That means it's not as likely to rain on you. So there's this sort of correlation that we kind of instinctively know, and it comes from this relationship, this interplay between the cloud droplet size and the size of the visible light. So I've always envied people who can kind of look at the sky and see the clouds and kind of read, the what's going on about the air flowing around and stuff. I've never really been able to do that, but there are just a couple of different kinds of clouds that happen to form. in the atmosphere. So the atmosphere, the lower part of the atmosphere, the troposphere, which is where all the clouds are, which is where the temperature is getting colder as you get higher up. And then the coldest part of the atmosphere is at the top of the troposphere, and then you get to the stratosphere where it gets hotter when you go higher up. The troposphere is basically about 10 kilometers high. It's higher at in the tropics and lower at the poles, but you know, basically about 10 kilometers, so 30,000 feet. You know, the cruising altitude, it's okay to get out your laptop and buy a drink on the airplane. That's where airplanes fly, sort of at the top of the troposphere, sort of about here. So up at that level, there are thin, sort of wispy clouds called cirrus. And there are also paths from these airplanes called contrails. So cirrus clouds form when you have more water vapor than the saturation value. So maybe 120% or 150% relative humidity, something like that. The water doesn't want to be there, and so it condenses into forming these ice crystals. But it's a slow process. So we've said before that you can have more water vapor than 100% relative humidity. It's just not energetically the way it wants to be. And if you give it some way to form droplets, it will happily do that. That's what airplanes do when they fly through. So they're flying through some air. The conditions have to be right. The air has to have too much water vapor in it. It's got to be more than 100% relative humidity. And then, you know, the particles coming out of the exhaust make little nucleation sites that can form these cloud droplets. So you get this line in the sky that follows the airplane, which is a contrail. So these contrails also then can sort of spread out and you know, the line goes away before the particles necessarily do. So the airplanes might be making more cirrus clouds than would have been there otherwise. And then there are, so that's up at sort of like 10 kilometers altitude. And then there's sort of nothing that happens for a large span of distance in the troposphere. And then you get these kinds of clouds down in the lower part of the troposphere. Cumulus clouds, which are where the air kind of goes up in a focused sort of a way. And so you get these sort of towers. And they tend to go up to about for anywhere from 0 to maybe 4 kilometers in altitude in parts of the world like ours. Actually, if you ever go to the equator, if you're ever, you know, like going to someplace that's real close to the equator, the cumulus clouds there can reach all the way up to the tropopause. And it's a funny thing because you don't really notice immediately that it looks different unless you're sort of into this and paying attention. But somehow the skies just look alien when you're close to the equator. It's a funny thing. Another thing is that the sun sets very, very quickly. It's just like that close to the equator. So everything seems a little odd, you know, when you're used to living sort of up here when you go down there. But anyway, in temperate latitudes like here, cumulus clouds tend to be sort of limited to the lower half of the troposphere. And then there are also sort of layered clouds called stratus clouds, which are the product of sort of really broad scale kind of upward motion, or you know, a boundary between two different air masses that makes the water, you know, condense out at that level. So stratus clouds, when you go outside and it's just like cloudy forever in all directions, those are stratus clouds. So but the clouds have an impact on the energy balance from the albedo too. So the visible, what the clouds do to the energy balance in the visible is to change the albedo of the Earth. And so in the visible clouds, do they warm or cool the planet? What they do to the visible light, they make the visible light zing back out to space, they increase the albedo of the Earth. And so everybody's looking at me like, you know, they're just going to tolerate this till I go away. So by increasing the albedo of the Earth, they cool the planet. Right. Okay. So there's an IR effect and a visible effect. So the visible effect tends to cool the planet. The IR effect tends to warm the planet. And we've got basically two different kinds of sort of varieties of clouds. We have the high ones, which are the cirrus clouds, and the low ones, which are the cumulus and the stratus clouds. So what is, let's see, let's do this. Let's do this by popular vote. So let's start with this one, the IR effect of the cirrus clouds. Do we expect that to be strong or weak? Relative to the IR effect of the visible. So yeah, popular vote says strong. And that's right. They're stronger, whereas the IR effect from the lower clouds, from the lower clouds is weak, because the lower clouds are at the same temperature of the ground more closely, right? So the colder the cloud is, the stronger the greenhouse effect from the cloud is going to be. So high clouds get dealt, you know, all the good cards in the IR, because they're up in the high altitude air where it's colder. Everybody good with that? Now the visible effect. Which of these two... let's see. So the visible effect of cirrus clouds. Let's ask about this one now, compared to the visible effect of the stratus and the cumulus clouds. Which one do you think has the strongest effect on the visible light energy balance? So let's say for the cirrus, is this going to be strong or weak? Relative to the low clouds. What do you think? Just based on what they look like, you can answer this. It turns out that cirrus clouds are kind of thin and wispy. There's actually something called subvisual cirrus clouds, which are clouds that are so thin you can't even see them, but you can measure that they're there if you have a particle counter or you know a light absorption or something like that. So because they are so thin and wispy, they are a weak effect on the albedo of the Earth. If you look down at the globe, the cirrus clouds don't really make the Earth all that much whiter, because they're just so, they're just sort of thinner. Whereas the lower clouds have a much stronger effect, just because they're denser. There's more droplets. You can't see through them, so the light can't get through them. That's because they're just more droplets there going on. So now the net effect of the cirrus clouds, are we going to say warming or cooling? Warming. We can talk just with our voices faster than we can talk with eye clickers, I guess. Yeah, because, okay, so we got this warming effect from the infrared and cooling from the visible, but the cooling from the visible is kind of weak and wimpy. The warming from the infrared is really strong and powerful. So the net for the high clouds is to warm the Earth. The net for the low clouds, we can sort of do the same kind of reasoning, and this is weak, and the visible effect is strong. Low clouds tend to cool the Earth. So this is supposed to be a lecture about feedbacks. And what we would like to do is put a cloud feedback into the climate. That would feed back to the temperature of the Earth. And as you'll see in lab, the intensity that the clouds mess with the energy budget is huge. It makes a huge difference in the number of watts per square meter whether you put a cloud there or not. I mean, you go outside and you can feel the sunshine. That's a lot of heat. And if you know, or if it's really dark and cloudy, you don't feel it. It's a much bigger difference actually than the heat that you feel just from the CO2 that's coming down. If you double the amount of CO2, you get something like 4 watts per square meter is how much you're messing with the energy balance. And it's important because you're doing that everywhere over the whole world. So this is not a small effect, but these effects on the clouds could be, you know, tens or even 100 watts per square meter. So these are really heavy hitters. They have a huge impact on the energy balance. And so, you know, if we warm the climate a little bit with some CO2, for example, then what do the clouds do? It's really not very well known. It's not clearly a positive feedback or a negative feedback, because it's sort of a difficult thing to deal with in a satisfying way, because the clouds require such close detail in the models if you wanted to actually do them from first principles the way you would like. So the way they do it is they come up with these schemes, these parameterizations that like a set of rules or something. If the temperatures are this and the winds are going that way, then you expect to find this kind of cloud. And then they test that against, you know, real weather data and try to, you know, figure out what the factors are that make it, you know, favorable for one kind of cloud versus another, or how big the cloud droplet sizes are or something like that. So it's not from first principles, but it's, you know, the best that can be done. The question is whether if you change the climate of the Earth, you know, those rules could change a little bit. You know, we know that Newton's laws of motion don't change, but these parameterizations to do clouds, they could conceivably change. And so there could be sort of feedbacks here that are going to be difficult to, you know, deal with in a thoroughly satisfying way with just models alone. So beginning on Wednesday and then for a couple of weeks, we're going to take a break from all this climate physics and talk about the carbon cycle, which is kind of fun for me because that's kind of what I you know, that's where my passion is. So that'll be sort of a break for me and maybe a break for you too. But when we get back after a couple of lectures to talking about the climate forecast, the fact that you can't do things like clouds from just first principles means that you got to kind of rely on observations, on you know, whether the temperature of the Earth has been changing and how it compares with the models. A model doesn't prove anything by itself. You have to sort of, because of clouds and other reasons, but in particular because of clouds, you have to sort of ground truth the models with real observations before it's anything that anybody would be willing to pay money to change, you know, CO2 emissions in response to. So there's one last sort of related issue with clouds, which is convenient to talk about now. There are little droplets in the atmosphere which are there because of human activity, which sort of act like clouds a little bit, and they also can affect the clouds. These droplets are called aerosols. They are, they're mostly sulfuric acid. And they come from coal combustion. So there's different kinds of coal. There's high sulfur coal, which is the cheap stuff, and there's low sulfur coal, which is the good stuff. And when you burn the coal, the sulfur comes out as sulfur dioxide, SO2, and then it gets converted to sulfuric acid, where it makes these little tiny droplets which scatter light, because these are much smaller than cloud droplets until they start to get, you know, wet in a cloud. And then eventually they fall out, and that's most of what acid rain comes from, is this sulfuric acid. So it's got this whole trajectory that kind of affects things on its whole path. And so some of the warming from the higher CO2 concentrations in the air has been kind of offset by cooling from these sulfate aerosols, from sort of smoggy air. That's mostly sort of a local thing. When the aerosols, the sulfur, doesn't fill up the whole and spread out throughout the whole atmosphere the way that carbon dioxide does. It tends to rain out within a week or something like that. So that's why they can burn high sulfur coal in Ohio and make acid rain in New York. It's kind of a regional scale thing. So there may be sort of regional cooling that's driven by this haze from coal plants that may be offsetting a little bit the warming from the CO2. But there's another effect beyond just the aerosols themselves. There's something called the indirect effect. Which is where the aerosols change the cloud droplet size. So it's come up a couple of times that in our conversations that if you have more than 100% relative humidity in the air, the water wants to form liquid, but sometimes it's kind of impeded from doing that because there's nothing to kind of form a liquid around. So in clean air, that doesn't have any particles in it, but just pure gas air, you tend to find, first you form one droplet, and then once that forms, more vapor sort of condenses onto it because it's the only game in town. And so you tend to make a few large droplets. Whereas in dirty air, you've got lots of these aerosols. They form, they are what they call nucleation sites. So they're like seeding the cloud. They enable the drops to form, you know, give it a place to start. So you get water sort of condensing on all of them, because it's really easy, and you end up with a larger number of smaller drops. And the effect of the drop size is what we talked about earlier, the scattering efficiency. If you make the drops smaller, they tend to be shinier. They tend to reflect sunlight back out to space better, and so they have a stronger cooling effect on the climate. And also, if the drops are small, they don't fall out as quickly. And so these scatter better. And they don't rain out as quickly. So they may persist for longer in the atmosphere, but the water may hang around and affect the climate for longer in the air before it provokes rain and comes out. So clouds are kind of like a loose cannon in the whole forecast. It's a really hard issue, and you know, so that's what it is. Okay, so on Wednesday we will start talking about the carbon cycle. Woohoo!